make a recommendation, don't step between Roger and Edith when it's over, but I am. Unless you are indeed a peacemaker, so you might work on that. Certainly appreciate everyone being here. It's wonderful. I mean, I look over the audience and it's great to see people on just about every row. And thank you so much. Not so much because I'm speaking again, because of the encouragement we give one another, and it's such a blessing. I just can't mention this enough, to be able to be together. And just look forward to these times that we can spend with one another. You probably do too, except for the preaching, but anyway. I was a couple things. One from last week, from Luke 24. There's a story there told about two people walking on the road to Emmaus, and of course that has been used by many people, and they certainly, I think, use some of it out of context. But it was brought to my attention last week that it would be very difficult for us to say there was two men. I put two men up. Several of the versions use when Jesus, he said, "Oh, foolish men," but I believe the person that brought this to my attention would be correct. That it would be difficult. We could not come to an unavoidable conclusion that we know one of them was a man, but it would be very difficult from even if you look at the translations other than Revised Standard and American Standard, they all use it. But other than that, when you go back and look at the Greek and you look at some things, we could not unavoidably conclude that one of those people might have been a woman. But we do know they were disciples of Christ, so I appreciate that being pointed out. We want to be as correct as we possibly can when we teach from God's Word, and we certainly don't want to say something that someone else might say, well, you're just picking and choosing what you want to say, and so we do want to be careful with that. Today's lesson, I was asked to preach, not specifically this lesson, but a lesson like this, so I won't tell you who it was so that you won't blame them for it if it doesn't turn out well. But they asked me to talk about a person, someone in the Bible that we can look at. I know I say this frequently. Elisha is one of my favorites. He is a man that I look at and I just think that we probably, when we talk about Elisha, you probably are going to visualize some things that may or may not be true about him. And we'll talk about that as we go on, because you've probably seen the drawings of Elisha and you've probably seen some of the things that happened to him. And so you automatically assume some things that may not be true, just like we talked about Daniel, especially when you're talking about his age. But when you go to 1 Kings chapter 19, in verse 19, we certainly can read about this man, starting with verse 16 and then 19 through 21. And we, you know, when we look at this, Elisha was chosen by God. And Elisha could make some choices on his own, but he certainly was chosen by God. He wasn't chosen by Elijah. He was sent. Elijah was sent to go see Elisha. And when we look at this, obviously this was probably, as we've talked about when we talked about Elijah, one of the most difficult times in Israel's history. When we look at their life and we think about how evil they had gotten at this point, especially the northern tribes. Now, the northern tribes had never done really well. Once Jeroboam drew them away from God to some degree, they just kept losing it and getting worse as they went along. And now we're with at this point with King Ahab. And he's not a good man. He's not a good man at all. Now, you're going to note that at the end of his life, he certainly did make some changes. And he seemed to be very sorry for some of the things that he had done. But not a good man. Not a good man. His wife was very evil. And they brought Israel down. But his son would do the same thing. He didn't last for very long. And then it got worse and worse until the Assyrians would overtake them. And God would allow them to go into captivity. And it's not going to be much longer than this. But let me talk about God's love here briefly. Elijah went to talk to them, and he tried to get them out of their sin. Now he's getting toward the end of his time. We don't find out very much about Elijah, except for this short period of time that I talked about a few months ago. We have about a 3.5-year period, and then we're going to have about... It's hard to figure out the exact time, anywhere from maybe 4 to 10 years now. And then his time as a prophet's going to be over. And when we look at this and we think about this, you know, Elijah had a tremendous courage. He showed that courage, and then his faith wavered a little bit, and then his faith comes back. And that's a wonderful thing. And so we're going to talk about a little bit about that today when talking about Elisha. But we look at all these false prophets and all the things that are going on around this period of time, and all of these people and all the false prophets that Elijah had killed. And we see a very difficult time. And so Elisha comes into this at that point. Now, that's a very, very good thing about him. So let's read this really quickly, or I'll read and you follow along, please. He tells about the ones he's going to appoint, and in the last part of verse 16, "And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place." And then it goes on to verse 19. "So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12. Then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, 'Please, let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you.' And he said to him, 'Go back again, for what have I done to you?' So Elisha turned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slaughtered them and boiled their flesh, using the oxen's equipment, and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and followed Elijah and served him." And we read over that, and you know, you read through that, and yeah, that's wonderful and all, and then you just move on. But there's a tremendous amount in all of this that we can learn. But let's look at the background of all of this as far as just Elisha. We're not going to go back through Israel. But his name means "my God is salvation," or "God is salvation." And, you know, they named their children a lot of times using El in the name because it meant a lot to them. And we've talked about this before. You can even read online some things that are written by Jewish people, and they still will not write out the name of God. They still won't do it. They were afraid to do so. But they would use them in their names because they wanted that to be prominent in it. And that's an interesting thing to me, that they would write that, but they wouldn't write that. But it says that he came from a city or an area of Abel-Meholah. Now, they have some ideas about where this might have been. It doesn't really matter. It's just an area that he came from, and he was sent there. And the reason, think about this for a moment. Where was this place? Doesn't matter. But God knew. God knew all the people that were there. He knew one man that was there that was already a follower of his. A man who, as we're going to look at, had just tremendous faith right from the get-go. And remember what he's living around. Now, think about this again. King Ahab and Queen Jezebel. Not a good time. Country's very bad shape. It's going downhill in a hurry. They're in wars all the time. They can't seem to get out of it. They're going to be fighting immediately after we learn about him, and it's just a difficult time. But God knew him. It says he was the son of Shaphat. That's the only thing we know about. We don't know anything else about this man. We don't know who he was. You would tend to think he must have been a pretty good man himself. We can know some things about him just by reading this text. If he had 12, that is 24 oxen, and he had that many to work, he's not poor. He's a man who has probably tremendous wealth, and he certainly, having that many, that's pretty amazing during that period of time, and had all that went with that, all the implements that went with it to work them, we can see. He's working the land. This isn't one man working all 12 yoke of oxen. This is a man who's working one yoke of oxen, and all the other 11 are being worked apparently by other people. So we can see those people being involved, and that's probably who he fed. Now, he is working, though, as a farmer for his father. He hasn't left home. He's there helping him. He's, a servant like the rest. He's not like the young man that we talked about, the prodigal son or the wasteful son. He's not a man who is asked, you know, give me what's due me. I want my own. He's there still working for his father. He understands what the wasteful son will understand when he finally gets so low and goes back. He already understands. He already knows. Now, he's a prophet of God from the northern tribes. And he's trying to get those 10 northern tribes to turn back to God. He's going to work around that area. And it's during the reign of these particular kings, Joram, Jehu, Jehoahaz, and Jehoash. And they were kings from about 852 to 796. So you see from this, he's going to be a prophet for anywhere from 50 to 60 years. He's not going to be a young man down the road. But this also tells us something else. He's not an old man right now. You know, you ever see the pictures of him? And you see that he's very old and he doesn't have any hair and all of that. There's some things we'll talk about that as well. But he certainly was a man who feared and served God faithfully. So as we look at that, we talked about this earlier. The first mention of him is that he's going to be Elijah's replacement. But he's not going to be a replacement immediately. He's going to go and serve with him. He's going to be with him for a while. So he tells Elijah, let me tell you where you can find him. He tells him his father's name, and Elijah goes and finds him. Elijah doesn't question this at all. Now let me stop for just a moment. I must back up. You remember what's happened to Elijah? You remember where he is? You remember where he's been? You remember how he fled Jezebel? You remember he's on the run? You remember he wants to die? He's at the low end of his life? Things aren't good? He's scared? His faith is starting to waver a little bit? You think God doesn't care? Of course he cares. He said, I'll take care of you. But he said in verse 14, but you've left me alone of chapter 19. I'm by myself. I don't have anyone. This is a very important point for us. How important it is that we have each other. You know, as husband and wife, sometimes the beauty of that relationship and the strength we can gain from one another, but we look at the church, we look at our fellow brothers and sisters, that's where we get our strength. We get it from each other. We have each other. Elijah at this point has been chased all over the place. He's looking around and there's no one with him. A very brave man, a man who stood up. And what does God say? Well, don't worry. I reserve 7,000 to myself. In other words, there's a group of people out there that are still trying to follow me. He knew one of them. He knew one of them was head and shoulders above everybody else. And he knew one of them would be there for Elijah. He knew one of them would be a blessing for Elijah. He knew one of them would get Elijah's strength back where it needed to be. Even though God can give us our strength, and we've used the terminology, God's the majority, and if we're with Him, we're with the majority. I like phrasing it that way. He don't need me. But I'm going to tell you something. Sometimes we need people in this life to strengthen us, to get our backs up, to say we can do this. Look at the change in Elijah. Have you ever thought about the change he made from this point forward? That for the rest of his life, he's there strong. He's back where he was because God gives him a man to walk beside of him. You think of how much Jesus appreciated his disciples, but you think of the three that he was closest to, what they meant to him, his personal friends while he was on earth. And you think of what strength we can gain from one another. What a blessing. And this man is a tremendous blessing. This man is more than willing to serve. As we look at this and we think of what Jesus said, a farmer, if he looks back, is not fit for the plow. What he's talking about there, he's not talking about a man like Elisha who says, I'd like to go at least kiss my family and tell them I'm leaving. And you remember Elijah's response to this? Well, hey, you know, okay. Go back again for what have I done to you? So in other words, it's like, I'm not telling you not to go back and do that. I'm just telling you that you've got responsibility here. I didn't come here because I chose you. I came here because God chose you, basically. You're going to make a choice. Now, how did he know that? Well, we wouldn't know it, but we can understand from the context. If we didn't know anything else, we'd understand that when he put his mantle on him, Elisha knew immediately, I've been chosen for something. You think he didn't hear about Elijah? You think he hadn't heard about that hairy man that goes around and that hairy man that stands up for God and that hairy man that everybody talks about that's standing there and he stands up and he says, stands against those evil prophets of Baal and Asherah? You think he didn't know about him and when he saw him coming, you think he didn't know who he was? And you think he didn't understand that when that mantle was thrown about him, I've been chosen? Now, he could have done a lot of things with this. He had choice. He could have looked up and said, No. I know what Jezebel's trying to do. I know what Ahab's trying to do. I mean, I even understand you've been a little bit fearful. I get this. I'm not getting into this. No way am I going to do this. But his only request was to kiss his parents goodbye. Now, I want you to think for just a moment. This is not a man that's, you know, 50-something years old and he's been there and he's strong. This is a man young. Probably, from the looks of it, I mean, if you take even how long he lived, we're going to say early 20s if he lived to be 80-something years old. He's not old. He's young. He's standing there working for his family. He understands the seriousness of this. He understands what can happen to him. This is not something that he doesn't understand. He says, well, let me just go tell them goodbye, basically is all he's saying. But he follows that, not with a sacrifice, but with tremendous sacrifice. Just in these few verses, we see the sacrifice that he made. And let's go through some of them. He's given up a comfortable life. He's living at home. He's being taken care of. Yes, he's having to work. But there's no fear there. He's just going through the field and plowing. He's looking at the land and enjoying the beauty of the land. There's nothing. He's living that. And as we talked about, you can tell from the Scriptures that they're not poor. They have a lot. But he gave up his two oxen. Apparently these were his. He's not giving up his parents. These two were his. These two he had responsibility over. These two he had used. These two were personal to him. And these two he gave up. And you know why he did it? He's letting it be known. I'm leaving. I won't be using them anymore. I'm not giving them to anyone else. Those were mine. But he doesn't just do that. Now, he's not sacrificing them in the sense of only the priest could do that. He's not sacrificing them. He's not making the mistake King Saul made. He's sacrificing them and he's giving them up to someone else. He's saying, I am gone. I will not be back. He took even the yokes and used those to burn the two oxen and cook them. The two ox. And then when he did that, he didn't get them for himself. It says he gave them to the people. He let them eat of the food. What a man. Just in this brief moment, we see what a tremendous man he was. But what he's really saying is, I'm giving up my earthly inheritance. I'm not going to be here. I'm not waiting around. I'm not waiting to get the farm. I'm not waiting to get all the things that belong to my parents. I'm going to serve my Father in heaven instead. When we look at this, and I said 5 to 10 years, it could have been anywhere 4 to 10. It's hard. Again, I tried to do the numbers, and I tried to look up numbers and everything else, and I finally gave up. So I just gave you this range. So if he's in his early 20s, he's going to be with Elijah at least for a few years. Let's just do it that way. He's going to be there for the rest of King Ahab's reign. He's going to be right there with Elijah through this whole thing. And I would encourage you sometime to read 20 through 22. You know, Jezebel has in this time period that follows, they have some wars. And you remember she takes Naboth's vineyard from him and gives it to Ahab and has him killed so that Ahab can have this vineyard that he wanted that was not rightfully his because the land belonged to him, Naboth. And as we look through this and we think about this, then they get into all these wars, and then in chapter 22, you know, the false prophets come and say, you know, no problem, no problem. You can defeat them. You can do this and you can do that. But they never went to the true prophets, Elijah and Elisha. And of course, Elijah was saying the whole time, it's not going to happen. Not going to happen. And then at the end of this, Ahab dies. And then as it talks about it in verse 38 of chapter 22, a prophecy is kept that he'd already been given by Elijah. Someone washed the chariot at the pool in Samaria. The dogs licked up his blood. Talk about King Ahab. While the harlots bathed according to the word of the Lord which he had spoken. Even though this man had changed, he had turned around. You will see in chapter 21, he recognized when Elijah said to him, see how Ahab has humbled himself before me, or the Lord said to Elijah, see how Ahab has humbled himself before me, because he's humbled himself before me, I will bring the calamity, not in his days, but in the days of his son, I will bring the calamity on his house. So God says, it's still going to happen. I'm keeping my word. And sure enough, when his son became king, he didn't last very long. Less than 2 years, as we find in 2 Kings, he was gone. He had fallen. And he had sought after the idols to get his health back, and God said that's not going to happen. So we find then that they also I'm just giving this as a history. When you go to 2 Kings 1, 1 through 18, that Elijah and Elisha are there together during King Ahaziah's reign. And when we see this, you remember this occasion, and I'd never thought about this until I read this time, so it might change your thought on this too. Remember, Elijah's up in the mountain, and obviously Elisha's with him. And King Ahaziah sends to him, and he sends 50 soldiers up there, or a captain of 50 with his 50 men, 51 people. And Elijah says, ask God to kill them all. And he does this twice. On the third occasion, when another captain comes up, he begs, please don't kill me. And he says, man of God, in verse 13, please let my life and the life of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. What's interesting about that is it's mentioned in the New Testament by James and John, because they want Christ to do the same thing, rain fire down and kill them just like Elijah had done. So they were quite aware of what had happened here. He's with Elijah until Elijah is taken away. So we see that he's willing to serve. He serves Elijah and he serves God. But he has a willingness to take on responsibility. You know, in 2 Kings 2, 1 through 11, this is recorded about where Elijah is going to go. And he tries to get away from Elisha. And he says, well, I'm going up to Bethel. And Elisha says, not without me. And you know, we talked about the prophets that have been killed and so forth. Now we're looking at the sons of the prophets. And they're there. They're standing by, working with these Elijah and Elisha. And he says, well, I don't want you to. And the sons of the prophets say, hey, he's going to be taken away. And he says, hey, you keep quiet. I'm going with him. So then he goes and he does this three times. Three times he says, I'm leaving you. And he says, no, you're not. No, you're not. I'm going to be with you to the end. I'm not leaving you. I've thought about this a lot. And I never realized before what he was really saying. I want to be with you to the very end. That's a blessing. When they get up to the river and they're getting ready to cross over, Elijah takes his mantle, he rolls it up, and he strikes it, and the waters part, and they cross over. And finally he says to him, Elisha, he realizes he's not going to get rid of him, and he says to him, okay, what may I do for you before I am taken away? Now Elisha asks something, and I want to put this in perspective. He says, I want a double portion of what you have, of your spirit. Now think about this for a moment. Flip over to Acts 8, and you've got Simon the sorcerer saying, well, I'd like to buy the gift of God with money. It would sound like on the surface that he's saying, I want more, I want something. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying, I want responsibility. I want to get out there and fight. I want to do what God wants me to do. And I want a double portion of that. I want to take on more. What a man. He knew the problems. He knew the dangers. He knew what was going on with the prophets. He knew the prophets were being killed right and left. He understood that. He's not afraid. He believes God will take care of him, and I want that double portion. And so Elijah says, well, if you see me taken up, you'll get it. If you don't, you won't. And of course, he did, and he got a double portion. And at first, like I said, it might sound selfish, but let me tell you something. With a double portion comes double the responsibility. He understood that. There's great responsibility in doing this. This is not when you receive something like this, when they receive something like this from God. We look at it as, wow, what a tremendous thing to be able to do. No, you had to do it within the realm of what God told you to do. Just like Solomon asked for wisdom and got it, God answered Elisha. And he said, I'll give it to you. He knew his heart. And let's look at his immediate faith in taking on that responsibility. In 2 Kings 2, 12 through 15, now Elisha saw it and he cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. So he saw him no more. He took hold of his own clothes and tore them into two pieces. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him, went back and stood by the bank of Jordan. And I've got a question for you. So when we start on our journey of faith, we become obedient to God. How quick are we to jump in? How quick are we to say, I want this? How quick are we to say, I understand this, and I understand what I need to do? There's no doubt in him whatsoever. None whatsoever. He took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water and said, "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" And when he also had struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. You know, we always think of Moses and the great faith that he had, but think about this man. Immediately, with tremendous faith, he never doubted. Not one minute. He knew he could do what he needed to do. He wanted that responsibility, and he's going to use it wisely. But he had a willingness after he told people things. He understood they needed to decide for themselves. He couldn't push the issue. He couldn't force it on them. And we find 2 Kings 2, 16 through 18. And they said to him, "Look now, there are 50 strong men with your servants. Please let them go and search for the master, lest perhaps the Spirit of the Lord has taken him and cast him upon some mountain or into some valley." And he said, "You shall not send anyone." See, they didn't understand. They were thinking, well, Elijah's just like Moses. He's died and they put him somewhere. And we need to go find him. We need to bury this man. He said, "You're not going to find him." But when they urged him, till he was ashamed, he said, "Well, send them out." Therefore they sent 50 men. They searched for 3 days and didn't find him. When they came back to him, for he had stayed in Jericho, he said to them, "Did I not say to you, do not go? Do not go." You see, he knows what's happened to Elijah. He's told them, "You're not going to find him." He tries to tell them, but they refuse to believe. They're not going to accept what he has to say. They need it on their own. They really have to figure this out. And he says, "Okay, all right." He understands. You've got to make your own decision. I understand that. So, go. But then when they did figure it out, he said, "See, I told you all along because I understood." But his willingness to use his gift for others. He goes into town and they say, "Hey, the situation is bad. The water is bad and the ground barren." He said, "Well, bring me a new bowl and put some salt in it." Now, there's nobody, the way we would think of it, would take salt and put it in perfectly any kind of fresh water and expect anything to happen other than you have salty water. Didn't happen. He took the salt, put it in there, cleaned the water up, cleaned the land up. He uses it for their good. We can see he's already thinking about the betterment of other people. There's nothing selfish on his part. This isn't to use this gift that God's gave him, this double portion to provide for himself, to take care of himself. You think about what would we do with something like that? See, he takes the time to help them. He could have thought his time was too precious for them. "Look who I am. I have a double portion of Elijah. Look how important I am." Not at all. He understood the need to be there to help others. He had served Elijah well. He understood that. He didn't argue about that. He understood he was not better than his master. But then his willingness to turn things over to God. This will be the last point we'll make during this time period. Just in this last little bit, I never realized, I don't think before, how much is in this one chapter. Verse 23, he went up from there to Bethel. As he was going up the road, some youths came from the city and mocked him and said to him, "Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head." Now, how many of you have seen the pictures? And they show these little children running out, and they show this older man with no hair, and they'll make a point, seemingly, in this picture that it's these little children making fun of this old man. This old man was less than 30 years old. He's not old at all. He has just become a prophet of God. He's under 30. He's not an old man at all. Now, the question comes. There's three possibilities of this. He either was prematurely, had lost his hair, not like Elijah at all, or he had shaved his head after Elijah died, or he, as many of them did, covered his head. And they just made an assumption. I'm not going to make an assumption on any one of them because Pam will stop me afterwards and say, "You can't come to that unavoidable conclusion." I'm getting ahead of her today. I'm thinking. Just kidding. I always appreciate when people correct me on anything. I want to be as correct as I possibly can. And I don't mean that in any funny way. I just shouldn't even probably make that joke. But anyway, in this case, he's very young. This is very disrespectful. Some have said, "Well, you know, they were just little children. I just cannot believe this. And God wouldn't do that to little children. And why would he do this? And why would he curse them and all of this?" Well, let's read on. So he turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. Then he went up from there to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria. Not much said about this. But it's probably one of the most important stories we'll ever read. When we look at this, and I just want to briefly go on this, the word is N-A-A-R in the Hebrew. It can mean, if you look it up, it can mean any age group from very young all the way up to 30 years old. Now, how would we know that? We're just assuming it? No. In Genesis 18, verse 7, Abraham had a young man dress out a complete calf. That's not a child. Children don't take a calf, and they're pretty hard to wrestle around. They're pretty heavy. No. No, this is a man who could have been somewhere in that age group. We see that Joseph is called that when he was 17 years old. That's not a young child. We see that in 1 Kings 20, verse 19, the young men there were of military age. So, not young. Not young. We can know from context these were not children. These were disrespectful young men. Who were they disrespecting? In reality, they were disrespecting God. Now, let's take what they said. They said, "Go up, you bald head." When we look at this and we think about this, they were showing absolutely no respect for a man that God personally chose. Now, he had a choice in it, but they were showing disrespect to him. I don't know why they were saying this. Some have said, well, maybe they knew about Elijah. I don't know, because the only one was there to see Elijah was Elisha. Maybe they were saying, oh, sure, you do it too. I don't know. Maybe they were saying to him, there was 42 of them, and they faced him down like a gang does and said, we'll show you. You're not going to bully us around. You're not going to tell us what to do. Don't know. Maybe they were just saying, get out of our territory. Whatever they were doing, I'm going to warn everyone in this audience, when you do that at any age, you violated God's law. And in reality, this violated so many things. I could have used a lot of passages about cursed is anyone who curses their father and mother, mistreats their father and mother. There's so many things under Mosaical law. Now, the New Testament, certainly, we're talking about Mosaical law here. They were old enough to be responsible for their actions. Even when it talks about those youths cursing their father and mother, he's not talking about little children. He's talking about children of an age that know exactly what they're doing. They are going against God's will, and they are responsible to God. And so they said this at least twice to him, mocking him. God had promised revenge for disobedience. He even said in Leviticus 26, 21, 22, if you won't obey me, I'll send wild animals among you. And he did this more than once and let the wild animals kill them. And people say, wow, I read where an atheist said, I wouldn't want a God like that. I thought, you've got a God like that and you don't recognize it. You need not to disrespect him by saying foolish things like that. And you should not disrespect his people. I thought this interesting. I don't know about you, but these were young boys. He used two female bears. There's a lesson here. You know what? You're not who you think you are. You're not that young man can run around and do anything you want to, because I don't even need male bears to kill you. I use two female bears. And of course, if most of you have been around, stay away from the female bears. I'm not talking about women. I'm talking about female bears here who have cubs. Stay away from them. They're the meanest animal on the face of the earth when they protect their own. As a last point, just use one example of this. I can use many of them where God finally took revenge and said, I'm going to kill you for what you've done to my prophets. But in Numbers 16, 1 through 34, it has impressed me for so many years where Korah, Dathan, and Abiram said, we want joint control with Moses. We want that. And God said, you will die because of that. Doesn't seem so bad, does it? Yeah. When God chooses someone and puts them in this position, there must be respect. And when we disrespect, like they did Moses here, you know what happened to them and most of their family? Except for some of Korah's children, the rest of them, the earth came and swallowed them up. Moses said, if you're going to do this, God, do something that's going to make it clear it's from you. And he did. So did Elisha do right? Absolutely. He said, you know what? I'm not taking care of this. He had tremendous power. He said, I could take care of this, but I'm not doing it. I'm leaving it in the hands of God. Whatever God chooses for these 42 youths, I'll leave it in His hands. Elisha was willing to serve. He was willing to take great responsibility. He was willing to let others decide for themselves. He told them the truth, but it was, you got to make up your own mind. He was willing to use his gifts for others. He was willing to turn things over to God. He was a great prophet. He was a great servant of God. You know, God called Elisha from very comfortable conditions to what could have been immediately dangerous conditions. He put his life on the line. He understood the seriousness of this, but he believed in God and he believed God would take care of him. He showed his trust in God by doing exactly what God demanded of him. He first served Elijah, and then by so doing he served God, and then later on just served God himself. The question is, do we have that kind of trust? Will we immediately say, I'm willing to go. I'm willing to use this. We've got to start somewhere. So the way we start is just like Elisha. Christ came to you and he said, through his word, he that believeth and is baptized should be saved, and he that believeth not should be damned. And he said through John that we need to be faithful till death. Whether it's a matter of death, that we get killed for it, or whether we just die, we have to remain faithful to that point if we expect him to save us in the end. Do we, any of us, need to do anything today to get our lives right with God? We do this as we talk about as a custom. We sing a song to make it very convenient for anyone. Would you please stand?